This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The full impact of HB2 is now being felt. Decisions by the NBA, NCAA, and the ACC to pull major games from around the state has led to a financial loss that is becoming painful. And that is why, for the first time in months, the governor and key members of the Republican legislature have said they would be willing to try and repeal the state bill that stopped Charlotte's ordinance that would have extended anti-discrimination protection to the LGBT community and would have allowed transgender people to use the bathroom or locker room of their gender identity. The catch is that the city of Charlotte would have to repeal their ordinance, which, though technically is now illegal, wouldn't be if the state repeals HB2. It was the first crack in the armor and one which the city council decided not to address yet. They could have taken it up at their meeting last night, but earlier in the day, Charlotte Mayor Jennifer Roberts reaffirmed the city's commitment to be a welcoming community that honors and respects all people. And then she went on to say,
"We appreciate the state wanting to find a solution to the challenges that we are facing. We applaud the governor for recognizing that the state needs to overturn HB2, which the state can do at any time without any action from the city of Charlotte. We are not prepared to add this item to our city council agenda this evening. However, we urge the state to take action as soon as possible, and we encourage continued dialogue with our broader community."
So now what? What does this mean, and where do we go from here? We spend the first part of our program talking about that with Tom Bullock from WFAE News and Dr. Michael Bitzer, professor of political science and provost of Catawba College. Welcome back to you both.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning. So Mayor Roberts said yesterday that she had no intention of bringing up the idea of Charlotte City Council repealing the ordinance that led the state to pass HB2. Did she do that on her own? Did she do that after a series of conversations with council members, with the Chamber of Commerce, etc.? Does anybody know?
No, we don't, Mike. We don't actually know the answer to that yet. But realistically, Jennifer Roberts will tell you that she has been a longtime supporter and proponent of LGBT rights. But regardless of whether or not she had conversations with others, there are others on the city council who did not want this deal. In fact, they even scoffed at calling it a deal to go through. You know, this is the second time that the Charlotte City Council has had an option to basically Raleigh offer this deal, an arrangement or whatever, where if Charlotte rescinds its expanded non-discrimination ordinance, which includes broader LGBT protections, the state would do something to House Bill 2. In May, that offer was, we'll change it in some way, but specifics were sparse. Now, last night, or over the last couple of days, it sounds like the full repeal of House Bill 2 was on the table. But there was a really interesting moment. I interviewed John Autry, who's a councilman here in Charlotte, and he's been a longtime proponent for LGBT rights. And this is how – you can actually hear his frustration at what the state was offering in this answer.
That's a circular logic. We'll repeal our ban on LGBT protections if you repeal your LGBT protections.
And again, that's – at the heart of this argument. That is, in fact, true. And he's not alone on the council by any stretch.
And in fact, Michael Bitzer, it has been said by people on city council that Charlotte doesn't have to do anything to repeal HB2. They can do that on their own. But isn't it true that if they did it on their own and we don't repeal our ordinance, then the ordinance would take effect?
Technically, yes. You know, the state law mandated, and in this state, basically, the state legislature has authority over what local governments can and cannot do. And if the state was to repeal their bill, their House Bill 2, then the Charlotte ordinance, which is still on the books, would then go into effect. So it is very much the dynamic of who's going to move first, who's going to blink in this political show-off.
The Charlotte Chamber has really been pushing this as a compromise, and I would imagine there are chambers across the region, Greensboro, Greenville, Cary, maybe Raleigh, pushing this to stop the bleeding. But the Charlotte Observer, in an editorial yesterday, I believe it was yesterday, urged council to do just what they did. Nothing. Is this a game of chicken? And if so, Who blinks first? Who wins?
I think that's the great unknown. I think that both sides are so entrenched into their position, and I would liken it to a prime example of the divide in North Carolina between urban and rural interests. The two legislative leaders, both Speaker Moore and President Pro Tem Phil Berger, represent rural Republican conservatism. This is a Charlotte urban liberal democratic issue. And I think for both sides, they have become so entrenched that they just do not see how they can give without alienating or antagonizing their own base within the state in an election year.
Yeah, I agree with Dr. Bitzer on that one. Although it's interesting to me, there are two points here that I think are worth pointing out. First and foremost, this is the first time that urban and rural, Democrat and Republican, have all come together on an issue regarding House Bill 2. It is hurting the state. It is hurting the economy and the reputation. This deal was actually brokered by a lobbying group that represents the hospitality industry statewide. So the fact that they've at least all come to see this as harming the state is, in fact, a breakthrough of a sort, because for a long time, Republicans have said, no, this is fine. It's not going to harm us at all. But it's also interesting to me, though, because if you ever doubted the animus between Charlotte and Raleigh, not the cities, but the government, it was fascinating. In a press release that was sent out yesterday, Senate Pro Tem Phil Berger, Republican, from a rural district, arguably the most powerful Republican in the state when it comes to the legislature, he actually gave some advice to the Charlotte City Council that said, hey, if you don't trust Raleigh, if you don't think we're going to really repeal House Bill 2, then why don't you just, you know, rescind your city ordinance contingent on House Bill 2 being repealed? And it was just really funny to see Phil Berger offering Charlotte a kind of a little
a
helpful advice, we'll say. A carrot, indeed.
What about that trust issue? Because there's no guarantee, if we had repealed last night the ordinance, that the state would have followed through with a repeal of HB 2. Or would there have been? I mean, it seems to me that we have reached critical mass, $100 million loss in incoming funds in Charlotte alone because of these lost games.
Well, that's just the estimate on the NBA All-Star game. The estimates, and these are estimates, we cannot verify these, but there are some estimates that put the damage to Charlotte alone at about $250 million.
Okay. So when you have that and you compound it with the loss of games around the state in smaller areas where these games may even mean more than they do in Charlotte, because they are major events for those cities.
And they don't have pro teams.
Can you as a legislator in good conscience not repeal this? Don't you have to repeal this to placate the forces that are working against you, the NCAA, the ACC, and the NBA, if you want to have any future?
I think it really came to a head with the ACC's decision. The NCAA, some Republicans criticize them for the hypocrisy and, you know, they're just a big money maker and they're going to throw their weight around. When you talk about the Atlantic Coast Conference and this conference that was born in this state, that was bred in this state, that Tobacco Road, for a native or even a non-North Carolina-born person moving into this state, when that conference sends the message that it sent, it really struck at not just at folks in urban areas, but folks in rural areas. I mean, the ACC is part of the culture of North Carolina, and I think that's when people went, Even strong supporters went, whoa, wait a minute, something is not right with this scenario.
So back in Raleigh, we played a little bit of Mayor Roberts saying why she wasn't going to, why the city council would not take up this issue at last night's meeting. Back in Raleigh, House Speaker Tim Moore said any blame for this possible repeal being stalled lays with her.
Charlotte started this. Charlotte needs to start with making the change to fix it if they think there's been a problem. There would not have been a House Bill 2 but for what Charlotte did. Given the opportunity to have a reset and have a dialogue, instead of taking that opportunity, the mayor simply insists on saying, not going to talk, going to continue down this road. And frankly, that makes me doubt their sincerity and want to see anything resolved.
Well, do we really have to do anything? I mean, seriously, the purse strings are being held by outside forces that are seriously doing economic damage to Charlotte and to other parts of the state. So why wouldn't we just wait this out until it becomes untenable for the legislature not to repeal HB 2?
Well, there's a couple things in that. That's a pretty big question. Let's unpack a couple points of it. First of all, your point of view as to who's to blame likely aligns with your view on House Bill 2. If you're a supporter of House Bill 2 and really see it as some kind of a bathroom protection bill, then you're going to see Charlotte at fault for doing, as Lieutenant Governor Dan Forrest said recently in a debate, a radical social experiment. If you think House Bill 2 is a dramatic overreach by Raleigh and is not necessarily needed because the data doesn't prove out that there are these, you know, potential for any increased attacks in bathrooms, then you're going to see Raleigh and say, hey, what you guys did this. Nobody is leaving the city because of what Charlotte passed or the state because of what Charlotte passed. They're leaving the state because of what Raleigh passed.
Right.
Then you're going to say, no, the General Assembly did this. They can undo it. That's what they need to
do.
But
money is where the rubber hits the road on this issue. If Charlotte just waits it out at some point, well, money call the shots.
Well, here's the thing. You just played a clip from Tim Moore last night, and there's the entire section that I've seen is about 6.5 minutes long. And you also see at the beginning of that, even though he said that he believed he had the votes earlier on before this press conference to have House Bill 2 repealed if Charlotte acted first, you also heard him start waffling on, well, we were thinking about, you know, changing House Bill 2. He never actually said that a full repeal was on the table in that interview. It seems to me that he may be walking it back because to his political base and many Republicans' political base, this could be viewed as a bit of turning their back on the values of the party that these people hold dear.
Bathrooms have been the centerpiece of this conversation over HB2, but there's much more to it. Mm-hmm. Were the businesses who declined to locate here and the NBA and NCAA and ACC decisions to not be here, were they predicated on the mandate that transgender people must be able to use the bathroom that conforms to their identities? Or were they also objecting to the parts of the bill that forbid local municipalities to enact LGBT protections that are greater than those provided by the state, which are, as I understand it, none?
With the CEOs that I've spoken with who pulled out, people like PayPal, and actually Braeburn Pharmaceutical, who decided to stick with a plan to expand in Raleigh because they are against House Bill 2, but they thought it was better to try to fight inside the system as opposed to just stay outside the state. It is, first of all of these are very intertwined. If you think about someone who doesn't follow this regularly, all of House Bill 2 is just kind of one big nebulous mess. But they actually see the protections as being the bigger issue. The bill actually allows private businesses to do whatever they choose with their restroom policy. So if you're a pizza joint in Plaza Midwood and you want to have your restroom be unisex, that's fine.
If you don't, that's fine.
And if you don't, that's fine. But what it boils down to for a lot of these businesses is the sheer perception that North Carolina is a non-welcoming state, and especially for high-tech industries, especially for businesses, larger businesses, Fortune 500 companies, when you're trying to recruit talent from all over the world and all over the country, any perception, if you're located in North Carolina, that this is a state that discriminates is going to hurt your recruiting, or that's their theory.
In 30 seconds, Michael, how much of this is just simple, pure politics, so that the governor can say, look, we offered up a compromise, and the Charlotte City Council dug in their heels. It's their fault, not mine. Vote for me.
It's all politics on all sides of this table and the issue. I think we're going to have to wait to see maybe in the next week or so public opinion polls how this is going to impact Cooper-McCrory race.
We're going to wrap up this conversation on the other side of the break that's coming our way right now. And when we continue after that, we'll talk about Wells Fargo and the pickle they find themselves in, specifically John Stumpf, who heads off to Washington to testify before Congress today. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Aldersgate, undergoing a transformative expansion of its 234-acre campus that will include 62 new apartments and villas. Details at aldersgateccrc.com. And WTVI PBS Charlotte's Carolina Impact, highlighting how backpacks in Gaston County help hungry kids and local teens experience outdoor adventures that teach leadership. Tuesday at 8 p.m. on WTVI PBS Charlotte. Alzheimer's disease disproportionately affects women. Almost two-thirds of Americans with Alzheimer's are women. That's the same percentage, by the way, of those who provide care for those suffering from Alzheimer's. And one of those female caregivers is Kim Campbell. She's caring for her husband, singing legend Glenn Campbell. She joins us to talk about her experience, and then we hear from other caregivers and those doing research to figure out why so many women are affected. That's tomorrow on this program at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the latest on the investigations into bombs in New York City and New Jersey and the stabbings at a Minnesota mall, suspects, persons of interest, and how these incidents are affecting Muslim American communities.
Join the conversation on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're still talking about HB2 and the political ballet between Charlotte and Raleigh, the pas de deux. Tom Bullock is with us from WFAE News, and Dr. Michael Bitzer joins us from beautiful downtown Catawba College, where he's sitting ensconced behind his desk as professor of political science and provost of the college. I'm assuming there's a lot of movement. There was a lot of pressure from the Charlotte Chamber on the city council to do something last night, and yet it didn't work. We did nothing last night. What does the mayor's resistance to being part of this compromise, for which there is such momentum on the chamber's part, say about the political muscle of the chamber?
I guess I'll jump in on that one.
Yeah.
I honestly think part of the problem in this situation, if you go back and look at what the Charlotte Chamber of Commerce has done on House Bill 2, they were incredibly late to the game. Very late to the game. You already heard, you know, you had statements from the Raleigh Chamber and a bunch of other chambers early on about their views on House Bill 2. And the Charlotte Chamber has just not really, they were really slow on this. And I think really, I don't want to doubt the political power of a business group. And the Charlotte Chamber of Commerce is a large business group. But I think that, my guess is that plays a part in the fact that they seem to kind of be jumping on now when it's convenient for all sides.
Will there be any political fallout, Michael?
That's going to be the big question. I think Jennifer Roberts, you know, is going to stand probably for re-election next year. She can get through this 2016 massive political environment and go into her re-election bid. But I think part of this is also understanding the dynamics of what Charlotte has done. And perhaps while the Chamber of Commerce is a core kind of, when we talk about special interest groups, they are the main representative in most major metropolitan areas. But Charlotte has moved politically more and more to the left. And I think what the dynamics show is that Jennifer Roberts recognizes where her city is politically, and while the chamber may be trying to get a pragmatic point of view across, that doesn't necessarily always jive with the political environment that the city finds itself in.
Yeah. Do we know for a fact that had the city council repealed its ordinance last night, that if they called the legislature into special session, that there would have been the votes to repeal HB 2? Do we know that for a fact?
Well, I don't think you can ever say you know that for a fact until people raise their hands or say aye or nay. But both House Speaker Tim Moore and Senate Pro Tem Phil Berger sent out a press release earlier that said they believed they thought that they had the votes to actually repeal it if Charlotte acted
first.
And
if the governor called the legislature back into special session and they had the votes to repeal HB 2 and they in fact repealed HB 2, what was there in place to prevent them from passing something else to replace HB 2 that would have been similar?
Nothing. I mean, the reality, I think political fallout is a big problem for them. I think they would be afraid of continued backlash. I think really they just wanted to put this to bed.
Yeah.
But I know I interrupted you, Dr. Bitzer.
No. I would agree with that. I would say that from a political observer's point of view, if somebody like Tim Moore, or even more importantly, Phil Berger, floats this idea, Phil Berger is one of the most powerful individuals in Raleigh, in state government. If he floated this idea, he'd be able to twist some arms to get what he wanted.
And one other thing I want to add to this is this happened after you saw at least three Republicans, including Jeff Tart here in Mecklenburg County, come out publicly to say they were pushing for the repeal of House Bill 2, full out. And that is before Charlotte got back into this conversation. So I think part of this is also corralling their Republican caucus to get everybody on the same page so it doesn't look like the party itself is starting to fracture on this issue.
And do we know if HB 2 is ultimately repealed that this will satisfy the NBA, NCAA, and ACC?
Yeah. I mean, that's what they have called for. Now, as you brought up, it matters on how it's repealed or if it's only partially repealed or the details matter here in essence. But if you look at the NBA statement, if you look at the NCAA statement, if you look at the ACC, PayPal, and a lot of other people, they're all calling for the bill to significant changes to House Bill 2, if not its full repeal.
More to come on this in days ahead. Tom Bullock, reporter for WFAE News, and Michael Bitzer, Dr. Michael Bitzer, professor of political science and provost of Catawba College. Thank you both.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Well, the Wells Fargo wagon is suddenly riding a rocky road after revelations of employees setting up millions of unauthorized accounts in order to hit sales goals and secure bonuses. Many of those employees blamed a high-pressure sales environment, but CEO John Stumpf says there was no incentive to do bad things and that the blame lays with those rogue employees who have since been fired. But the bank is paying millions in fines, and Stumpf is in Washington today to testify on Capitol Hill. This whole affair has put big banks back into a spotlight they hoped had been extinguished. Are there more shoes to drop at Wells or other banks? And what does this mean for those in Washington who want to tamp down some of the banking reforms that arose after the Great Recession? Here to talk about that and more is Rick Rothacker, assistant business editor of the Charlotte Observer, and Hillary Burns, banking, finance, and entrepreneurship reporter for the Charlotte Business Journal. Welcome back to you both. Good morning.
Thanks for having us.
And they're both in our Spirit Square studio, and joining us by phone is Nancy Bush, a banking industry analyst with NAB Research. Nancy, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Rick and Hillary, let's go back. Just a quick recap here. Who discovered the fact that Wells Fargo employees were opening these bogus accounts in order to raise their own, bonus rates?
Well, the LA Times gets credit for a big story in 2013 outlining sort of this pressure cooker sales culture at Wells Fargo. I think there had been a lot of feelers out there before that there was a lot of pressure on employees, but they really kind of brought it to attention. Wells Fargo has said they've kind of learned about some of it even back to 2011 and were working on trying to tamp it down, but obviously they didn't. And then the big settlement came out just a few weeks ago.
And Hillary, the rough estimate is that 2 million accounts were opened without the knowledge of the customers, and this was done by bank employees. How long had this been going on before it was discovered? 2 million accounts is a lot of accounts.
Yeah, well, it was 1.5 million accounts and then okay. 500,000 credit cards, which is, yes, it is a lot. So Wells CEO John Stumpf has said that, like Rick said, this kind of he was seeing murky sales practices started back in 2011, and they put in oversight, and they've been working on it since then. But this has been going on for the last 5 years.
So what was supposed to be happening? What were these employees supposed to be doing to raise their own bonus levels and to bring customers into the bank, or also to increase the number of products that customers used?
Well, Wells Fargo for decades has been known for cross-selling, and the idea is that if you've got a mortgage with them, hey, why not get a checking account with them? And so they would have goals. We want our customers to have as many as 8 different products with us. And over time, the goals in the branch were, this month you need to, every employee, you need to sell 10 accounts. And so eventually, if you weren't making this goal, you might make up an account or give an extra account to, or extra credit card, extra account to a customer to meet their goals. I think there was a lot of sales pressure, not just to get bonuses, but to keep your job. So if you're it's into January and you've only sold 9 accounts, what do you do to keep your job? And so that's the real tough pressure on employees. So were they doing this to keep their job or to make a lot of money?
So Rick just mentioned cross-selling. Nancy, in an article in the Wall Street Journal about this, Emily Glazer writes, the term cross-sell appears 20 times in the latest annual report by Wells Fargo, which calls its branches stores. I don't think that's unusual, and has the highest return on equity of any large U.S. bank. Cross-selling is what these employees were charged with doing. Is there anything, Nancy, intrinsically wrong with that?
Well, I think it depends on your view of what banks should be doing, okay? And this is a view that I think is in transformation right now, partly as a result of the financial crisis. But, you know, I'm old school, and I believe that the first and greatest responsibility of banks is, A, to protect your deposits and to encourage the growth of those deposits. So, I mean, I acknowledge that this is distinctly old-fashioned idea. But, I mean, I think there's a question here, an existential question for banks. And it's, you know, what are you supposed to help your clients do? Do you put them in more debt or do you help them build their wealth?
Sorry, Nancy. Okay, I was just going to add that cross-selling isn't exclusive to Wells Fargo. In fact, yesterday I typed in cross-selling in our navigation bar, and it was amazing how many institutions, stories about different companies and institutions came up. Bank of America, all the banks in town do cross-sell, and there's nothing inherently wrong with that. It's the pressure on top of that to meet these intense goals that cause problems.
So in the case of Wells Fargo, Nancy, were they trying to get people to open up checking accounts and money market accounts and buy CDs, or were they trying to get them to take out mortgages, or all of the above?
All of the above, because at Wells Fargo, the primary account, the account that was most emphasized, was the checking account.
But deposits are liabilities. Deposits are liabilities for banks. Why would anybody want to increase your liabilities versus increasing?
Well, don't forget, you do make money on deposits. You lend them. That's how you make money as a bank.
Okay.
That's the old-fashioned way. You take in deposits, you make loans. But I think it was the particular way that they were doing it and the subset of products that they were trying to push and, you know, it was a culture, and this culture goes back a long way in Wells Fargo. And it was a sales culture that was built around a number that we now know to have been bogus.
Yeah. The Wall Street Journal.
I think that's for analysts like me, this is the issue. Okay, this is what this company was built on. You know, and now we know it was not built upon a rock.
The Wall Street Journal.
I think that's the problem.
The Wall Street Journal reports that the average Wells Fargo customer, or the average person, it has 2.71 products at their primary bank.
It doesn't make a lot of sense.
No, that would mean a checking account, money market CD, maybe a credit or debit card or a mortgage all combined there. Banks want you to have more of their products, and they often offer incentives, including savings if you do. I don't think that there's anything wrong with that. Don't customers win when they take advantage of some of these extra things that the banks want them to have?
Potentially, but there's not always a big advantage that, you know, it's not like your cable company where you may be getting a big break. You know, especially nowadays, it's pretty easy to shop around and you might actually find a better deal at another bank. So sometimes it's more in the bank's advantage than your own.
I don't know what cable company you use.
Well,
I don't get any breaks from mine.
It does make life a little easier if you do have, you know, your financial life in one or two places instead of all over the place. But you don't need product. No one should have products they don't need.
So, well, I was going to ask, where do customers lose in this bargain?
I think if the easy thing seems to be you walk in the branch and they say, hey, you want this other account, then you're not shopping around. You're not deciding, wait, there actually is a better deal at an online bank or at the bank down the street. Potentially, there's convenience, though. You know, you go to one website to check all your products. I mean,
yeah,
there's the convenience factor,
yeah,
but you may not be getting the best rate.
So one employee,
I think that's particularly true with credit cards as well. I mean, there are so many different credit card offerings out there. You really do have to shop around for a credit card, and just taking one as an auxiliary product at Wells Fargo has never been the way to go.
Yeah. One employee quoted in that Wall Street Journal article who quit Wells Fargo in 2014 said he was fed up with sales pressure and what he called unethical practices. And if you could sell, he said, you had a job. How unusual is that at financial institutions? Aren't they all incentivized? I mean, every time I bank with two or three different locations, every time I walk in, they ask me, don't I want a debit card? Don't I want a credit card? Don't I want to do this with my money? Don't I want to move some money out of a checking account into a money market? They all ask these questions.
Well, yeah, and I would say all industries, all salespeople have incentives. That's how sales work. But when you're trying to tell people to buy products that aren't in their best interest, that's where the problem lies.
So this cross-selling, is it more important today, and has it been more important in this low interest rate environment, Nancy, than prior to this low interest rate environment? And in this environment, how else do banks make money?
Well, I think that's part of the question here about what is a bank. But yes, it has absolutely been more important in this low rate environment, where generating fee income and, you know, the maximum amount of net interest income is absolutely the only thing that keeps those, you know, all important quarterly numbers going up. So, yes, it has been more important, but I think it's also part of the evolution of the way banks see themselves, which has changed very dramatically over the past, you know, 40 years.
How do they see themselves today?
Well, I think they see themselves as retailers, or they have come to see themselves as retailers rather than fiduciary institutions. And I think that's where the problem is. And this is where we've got to come to some kind of consensus.
So what you're telling me is
what banks are.
During the Great Recession, the question became, shouldn't we split these big investment branches away from banks and let banks be what they used to be, retail places where you can go in and get a checking account and a savings account and a safety deposit box? What you're telling me is we have problems within the retail banking side that having lost their way.
Well, I think, I mean, that's my own opinion that that's true. But you know, bringing back Glass-Steagall, which is what you're talking about, is not going to fix that.
Hillary.
I think what is going to fix that is a real rethink of the kind of financial system that we want. And believe me, nobody has taken the time to figure that out.
Hillary.
And a lot of analysts that I've seen their reports on have said that maybe that's part of the reason this has gotten so much attention. This is affecting consumers directly, everyday people, and it's easy to understand. So that's one thing.
I'll tell you what's not easy to understand. How you open 1.5 million bogus accounts in the names of customers who already exist without their knowledge. How were these accounts funded? There has to be money in these accounts, or they're not accounts. How were they funded for so long?
In some cases, it seems like they were taking money from your primary account, moving it into the secondary account. Then suddenly there might not be enough money in the primary account, and so there were fees.
But didn't customers suddenly realize, okay, I know I have, I don't know, $800 in my checking account. That's the only account I have, and now I only have $400. Where did that go? Now, didn't they notice?
Well, I think one of the lessons is check your statements, check your accounts, check your credit reports, because you may not be on top of every credit card you have out
and
there.
And you mentioned, so there were fees. You're saying that there were fees charged to customers on accounts that were not properly funded, even though they didn't open them in the first place?
Yeah, if you end up having an overdraft because you didn't have as much money as you thought, or there was some sort of, you know, on a credit card, there might be an annual fee and you weren't staying on top of that because you didn't realize you had it.
And people don't notice this?
If you didn't realize you had this account, I think you might not stay on top
of
it.
If you didn't notice you had an account, but suddenly you had a fee on that account, wouldn't that get your attention? I don't understand this.
The Wall Street Journal reported one anecdote that was about a homeless woman came in and had multiple accounts open for her and then was charged for not meeting the minimum deposit requirements.
Well, part of the problem, as I understand it, is that a lot of these, some of these were credit card accounts, which were opened by the bank for high dollar customers as a way of saying thank you for your patronage. And if you didn't want the card, then you were told to cut the card up when it arrived, and that would be the end of it. But of course, that doesn't mean that they closed the account, correct?
Well, they actually, in Stump's testimony today that's been out already, he talks about they need to go back through and look at what accounts haven't been activated and should they talk to the customers. So I think they're still reviewing what's legit and not.
When we come back, I want to talk about how much money may have been lost by customers and if that money was in fact restored to them. And also, what's going on now with this testimony in Washington, what might happen, what's going on at the bank, what's going on behind the scenes when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Malak Jewelers, the diamond specialists at the Arboretum, a direct diamond importer dedicated to teaching customers about diamonds and fine jewelry to make an educated decision. MalakJewelers.com and the Charlotte Symphony, opening the classical season September 30th and October 1st with an all-Tchaikovsky program featuring the Master's Violin Concerto and Fourth Symphony. Details at charlottesymphony.org. The latest on the investigations into bombs in New York City and New Jersey and the stabbings at a Minnesota mall. That's coming up next at 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show. Suspects, persons of interest, and how the incidents are affecting Muslim American communities. That's the topic they'll be talking about. If you'd like to join us in our conversation, you can reach us at WFAE. Well, you've got Charlotte Talks at WFAE.org, WFAE on Facebook, or get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
It's your world. We help you explore it.
We now have a defense of parking refugees on a remote Pacific island, Australia.
It's your community. We help you understand it.
ACC officials say they canceled their events because HB 2, which limits protections for the LGBT community, is not in line with their non-discrimination values.
Morning Edition on WFAE is an essential way to start your day and stay connected to your world. Listen weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about Wells Fargo being under scrutiny for unscrupulous practices. That's a way to put it, I suppose, with Hillary Burns from the Charlotte Business Journal and Rick Rothacker from the Charlotte Observer. Also Nancy Bush, who is a banking industry analyst who's working in New Jersey with NAB Research. Do we know how much money this cost customers? Did it cost them anything? If so, was the money restored?
So far, Wells Fargo says they've restored about $2.6 million, I think was the latest figure, to customers. So people were getting checks. The average was $25 per person, so it wasn't massive per person, but they've proactively started sending out refunds.
How many customers have they lost? I mean, if that happened to me, I would no longer be a customer.
I don't know if we know that number yet.
Yeah, we don't know that yet, and probably are not going to know it for many months as this becomes more publicly available.
As I understand it, Wells Fargo fired first about 200 people in their West Coast region where sales practices were described there by the bank as being very aggressive. And that number of people who lost their jobs would grow to about 5,300 over time. Is it conceivable that very highly placed people in the bank were unaware of these practices until 2015 when the LA Times and maybe some people in the West Coast branches began to notice some suspicious activity? Is it possible that they didn't know?
They certainly knew about it going – I mean, from John Stump's testimony that's going to come out today, they knew about concerns as early as 2011. Whether they knew every action, you know, maybe that's a question, but they've known this is a problem for a while.
So, Nancy, when banks internally notice something odd going on and they start to investigate, what are the red flags? What were the red flags here internally?
Well, I mean, this is the part that's very mysterious for people like me. Now, I've been covering Wells Fargo. I covered it prior to the Wachovia deal. I covered it back to the Norwest merger with old Wells Fargo. So it's over 20 years. And I don't understand the entire sequence of events here. If they knew about this in 2011, why did they not send out the troops at that point, you know, go through everything and find out the extent of the problem and stop it then? This is the big mystery question that I hope Mr. Stumpf will address today. But it just doesn't make sense.
Is this part of the Norwest culture or part of – we know it's not part of the Wachovia culture. So is it part of the Norwest bank culture or is it part of the original Wells Fargo culture?
Yeah, Crossell goes back to the old Norwest, to Dick Kovacevich and the old Norwest culture. Dick was, you know, in retail or in other businesses other than banking. He was at
General Mills, maybe, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, so he was in other businesses and then went to Citigroup. And Citigroup was, at the time, Dick was there, another very aggressive sales bank. Mm-hmm. And so this goes back to the Dick Kovacevich days.
Carrie Tolstedt, who was the head of retail banking at Wells, announced her retirement after 27 years at that bank and its predecessor, Norwest. She must have known what was going on, did she or did she not? And was her retirement a result of what was about the shoe that was about to fall?
We don't know if she knew at the time. I mean, the bank is claiming that this was not in any way sanctioned or incentivized. That's what Stumpf is saying today. But her retirement was announced in July, and the position is actually now moving to Charlotte with Mary Mack, who's also a longtime banker at Wells. But
with Wachovia and First Union.
She's from the Wachovia roots, yeah.
But when Tolstedt's retirement was announced, Stumpf talked glowingly about her and her work for the bank. So you'd think if there was a problem there.
Did we know about this problem when he made those remarks?
Did we know about this? No, that was back in July.
So could it be possible that he didn't know back in July?
Well, they certainly knew about issues back to 2011. The LA Times story is 2013, so they knew about some issues, and it's hard to believe it's not some kind of connection.
So Carrie Tolstedt.
I would just also point out, guys, though, that they probably were in regulatory negotiations at that time.
At which point you just don't talk about stuff publicly.
Okay,
They were waiting. They were negotiating the settlement at that time. So, you know, that's why I don't think we heard anything about it this summer.
So Carrie Tolstedt was paid $9.1 million in salary bonus and stock awards in 2015 and retired with tens of millions of dollars in unvested stock and options. Some have said that the bank should now claw back some or all of that money. What would that take, and where does that stand?
Well, we're going to hear a lot about that today, I'm sure, at the hearing. It's a board decision. There are, and you look at the proxy, there's different procedures for taking money back. A lot of it's about money that causes the bank to restate the earnings. That's not going to happen here. There certainly will be pressure, though, particularly on options that haven't vested yet. And that's been a big, you know, big talk since the financial crisis. Shouldn't if someone gets a big bonus for something that ends up causing a big problem, shouldn't that money come back?
Of course, those options are worth less than they were before this came out because the stock price has fallen, correct?
A little bit.
The bank was fined $185 million by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Put that number into perspective. That's not a lot of money, is it? For a bank.
Not for this bank. I mean, they make $5 billion per quarter in profit.
So this is a couple of days worth of profit.
Yeah, but I think we need to put this in perspective, Mike. This is the first installment.
Okay. All right.
There's going to be more to come. when they announced the settlement with the city attorney of Los Angeles, you can bet that every city attorney, state's attorney general, everybody else where Wells Fargo operates, has now got their hand out, and they're going to say, you know what, we're next.
Wow. We've also reported that the U.S. Attorney's Office here in Charlotte, as well as in San Francisco, are going to dig into this, and that could be some sort of civil or criminal issue, and that could cause more money being paid out by the bank
Although the West Coast seemed to have been particularly aggressive in this cross-selling approach and some of these bogus accounts, did this happen across the country wherever they had banks?
It did seem to be nationwide. We've heard of some in this area in the East Coast. If you remember, the Wells Fargo transition into when they took over Wachovia was being rolled out over this time period. So around 2011, the transition was complete. So I think in 2011 time period, it was starting to hit the East Coast.
What have the two of you, as local banking reporters, heard from Wells employees who used to be Wachovia employees about the change in culture?
I would say it was a big transition. You know, Wachovia, at least on the retail bank side of things, had talked a lot about customer service, had gotten some good ratings, and was very proud of that. Wells Fargo came in, a stronger sales culture, I think more pressure on that side of things, but certainly had been a bank that still had a very good reputation.
And one thing that I keep is making this story even more confusing for me is how prideful Wells Fargo employees are of their culture, how much they talk about it, how much they put it on a pedestal, really, compared to other financial institutions, and it just seems something went very wrong.
Well, Wells Fargo has always been considered or looked upon by many as a clean bank. Bloomberg.com has referred to John Stumpf, the CEO, as the Mr. Clean of banking. Mr. Stumpf says he holds himself accountable now for what happened, but he doesn't plan to retire, and he also says there is nothing in our culture, nothing in our vision and values that would support any situation where a customer got a product they did not request. It is just the opposite, he said. So what does that statement say to you, Nancy, about Wells Fargo and or about John Stumpf?
Well, I've known John Stumpf for a long time, and I will say that this is not the John Stumpf. This type of practice does not represent the John Stumpf that we know. But having said that, I think one of the questions is going to be very important today is who knew and when did they know it? And, you know, do I think that John Stumpf will necessarily survive this? No, I don't. I think his resignation may be being held in abeyance as a bargaining chip with regulators. So, I mean, I was a Wachovia customer up here in New Jersey when Wells Fargo took them over, and I would go back to your question before. Enormous difference. The people, the Wachovia folks at the local branches here, when the Wells Fargo culture started to be emphasized, were scared to death. And I don't know how many of them actually have survived that. I know that many Wachovia employees did not survive that transition to the sales.
And did you notice that as a bank analyst or as a customer? In other words, would normal customers who don't do what you do for a living have noticed that change?
Probably not. I mean, I actually when it was all going on, I would sort of saunter into the local, you know, my local branch, my local store, and you know, just ask people questions, you know, very quietly, and I'd get this, you know, I would get this very delicate approach to the sales culture. You could tell that it was coming in, right, but they didn't really know how to deal with it, and they didn't know how to institute it.
Aside from a possible resignation that might be forced upon John Stumpf because of regulations or regulators, the Observer, Charlotte Observer, Dion Roberts reports that bank analysts have called on Wells Fargo to slash his pay. FBR and Company, that's an analyst, says Stumpf should agree to not take a bonus this year or to work for just a dollar. Another analyst, Mike Mayo of CLSA, suggests the bank should reduce Stumpf's compensation in an effort to hold him accountable. Do you see those as reasonable suggestions or suggestions that are enough? Nancy.
I see them as very reasonable. I do not believe that any member of senior management who was involved in this should receive any bonus, any, zero, this year or in any year in which this bank has to pay out money related to settlements here. In addition, I believe that they should reward their employees handsomely at year end for having to go through this. This culture went too far and it went on for too long. So I think the employees need an apology in tangible terms. And don't forget, we have not heard from the one important voice here, and that is Warren Buffett, who is the largest shareholder, has been a champion and cheerleader for Wells Fargo for years. And my view is that his say-so behind the scenes is going to be very important here. But this board of directors has got to come to life and make this known.
Why haven't we heard from Warren Buffett? You know, he also has a stellar reputation as an investor and a person who guides other people's investments. He's been incredibly successful over time. Is this a blemish on his record? Why haven't we heard from him?
I don't know why we haven't heard from him. I think we will hear from him. I suspect he's going to let John Stumpf say what he's going to say and let the process sort of run its pace right now, because I don't think his intervention in it would be particularly helpful. But I am pretty confident that we will hear from him somewhere down the line.
Senator Elizabeth Warren, who's on the Senate Banking Committee and who will be part of these sessions today, has had some fairly severe things to say about all of this. And she's said a lot of severe things to say about big banks in general. Will John Stumpf find among the Republican majority of this committee at that hearing in this election year friends or people who will be protecting their flanks in an election year?
It'll be very interesting, because there's been a lot of talk among Republicans that the CFPB, the consumer banking agency that did the biggest fine here, isn't necessary. It's poorly run. It's a little bit of a loose cannon. And this is going to be the best example of the CFPB finding wrongdoing and punishing.
What impact might this have on those who want to lessen restrictions on banking?
I think it'll make it harder. It's been a strange election year, obviously, and banks have not really fared that well in the election. No one's been that big a fan of banks. And here's going to be front and center a banker doing wrong. And Elizabeth Warren was the champion of the CFPB, and she's going to have a great platform today.
What's the worst that could happen as the result of a Senate hearing?
Well, we could see John Stumpf, like Nancy said, eventually will he keep his job? I think from his standpoint, that certainly will be big, and we're going to see more and more lawsuits and other things related to this for Wells Fargo.
Consumer advocacy group Public Citizen has filed a shareholder proposal urging Wells Fargo to study the idea of breaking itself up, saying that the bank is too big to manage. Nancy, you're a bank analyst. Is that a good idea?
No, I really don't think it is. Number one, how would you break it up? Now, this is, you have to remember that we're not talking about a company with huge capital markets operations. You know, if you're talking about J.P. Morgan Chase, it's like, okay, great. You separate the investment bank from the retail bank. You break it up that way. But we're not talking about a similar situation in Wells Fargo. We would be talking about it, a breakup of this company, breaking it up geographically. And when you have a unified deposit platform, a unified operating platform, that is extremely difficult to do.
Larry, one of our
two huge banks as opposed to one mega huge bank.
Larry, one of our listeners, very quickly calls this theft. If you or I had done this, it would have been fraud at the worst, identity theft perhaps at the worst, I don't know, but certainly theft. And he says, and yet no one is going to jail. Why is no one being prosecuted?
We don't know that yet.
Yeah, it's still a possibility.
Too early to tell.
U.S. Attorney's Office is looking into this, but he's right. I mean, there hasn't been a lot of bankers go to jail, certainly, since the financial crisis, so that's going to be a big issue today.
From everything I've read, the bank did not try to hide this once it was discovered on its own, and once it was discovered by the L.A. Times, they didn't deny it. They went ahead and investigated. They got to the bottom of it. They fired 5,300 people involved in it. They changed policies. They told the world. So have they done the right thing here?
They have been. I mean, today John Stumpf, in his testimony that was released, has said he's taking full responsibility. They have eliminated sales goals by January 2017. Those will be gone, he says. And they now have put in place different tools. For example, customers will now get automated emails when they open accounts so they know. So I guess we will see.
So what does John Stumpf have to do to save either his job or to save the reputation of Wells Fargo or to not hurt other big banks who are looking at this going, oh, my God, what has he done or what have they done?
Well, the biggest thing is and he's already has this in his testimony, that he's apologizing pretty severely. But earlier on, you know, just last week, he was sort of blaming the lower-level employees, and that did not go over very well. So if he does that again, that will be trouble.
Rick Rothacker, assistant business editor of the Charlotte Observer. Hillary Burns with us in our Spirit Square studio, bank finance and entrepreneurship reporter for the Charlotte Business Journal, and Nancy Bush, banking industry analyst with NAB Research. She joins us by phone from New Jersey. Thank you all.
Thanks.
Thank you.